Good morning, everybody.
Welcome. It's nice to see people here. I'd like to thank again Ellie and Henry and the organizers for inviting me and also for copying my sheet. We have a lot to talk about today, but a little bit less than we had to talk about last time, so we could go a little slower. But nevertheless, we don't want to rest on our laurels, because this is a very detailed and complex topic. Ellie gave me a title, which actually turned out to be prescient, because I think he summarizes this subject perfectly, which is Rav Yosef Karo, Halachist and Mystic. And I think we all have some background in his halachic life and the Shulchan Aruch, and we'll talk about that obviously in detail. But the effect that Rav Yosef Karo had as a mystic on life that we see around us today, we'll see how that perhaps is more than people even imagine. And the two really go together, which is why I've chosen to start the show with a quote from the Magid Meisharim. The Magid Meisharim, we'll see it out soon, is a sefer which Rav Yosef Karo wrote chronicling his discussions and, if you like, the messages he received from this voice that he called his Magid. We'll talk about that more soon. And he heard that voice for 40 years, the last 40 years of his life, and it says a lot of interesting things to him. And this is one of the things it said, which I think ties together the whole topic. Number one, L'chein chazak ve'emet. He tells him, he gives him a lot of, with support, moral support. The Torah ka, she'ata oseh, the Torah ve'mishnah, you must be strong in your Torah, the Mishnah, the Gemara, Rashi, the Tosfot, uve psak, uve kabbalah. When it comes to psak and kabbalah, why? Ki atam mekasher otam ze bazeh. Because what you can bring, says his voice to him, is you can tie them together. You can make a kesher between sect and halakha in a way that perhaps other people can't, which is why halachist and mystic is, I think, a great title. V'kol malchei maram dorshim shlomcha v'tovatcha. Everyone's rooting for you, says the Magid. Everyone on high supports you. Artis ta'er b'menazot. Don't worry about the bills. You'll pay the bills. Ki kfar amatid ha'as panin eimis far. I've already told you so many times. Ki par nadavcha mezumenet. I wish I had a Maggie that said to me that kind of thing. Okay? Your pronounce is assured. It's already been set aside. Lotak so davar, you won't lack. Don't worry. Ki ata mushkach ma'od v'kolin yanecha. Raki tidvak vi ubatarati ubirati ubamadati. What is the Maggie? We'll talk about that soon. What does it mean that he had this voice? What was it saying? Could anyone else hear it? We'll see how that works. I wanted just to bring that as an opening line, because this Sak and Halakha tied together is really what we're going to talk about today. Let's talk a little bit for a few minutes about the historical context and the biography of Rav Yosef Karo. I brought you a picture which is almost certainly not his picture, but that's the one that you find on the internet, and that's the one that people have in their sukkahs, and therefore that's as good as we can get. There is no authenticated portrait of Rav Yosef Karo, but this one looks good enough. But this is his signature. I brought you underneath it. That is his original signature, and therefore we begin to get into his life. The golden age of Spain was already over by the time of the Ibn Ezra that we discussed last time in 1150, 1160. Of course, by 1391, things had really gone very, very downhill, and there was an outbreak of enormous pogroms. Many thousands of Jews were killed in Spain already in 1391, 100 years before the ultimate expulsion. And Jews began to leave. They began to go elsewhere. And one of the places they began to settle was Eretz Israel. And over the 100 years of the gradual breakdown of Spanish society, the Spanish presence in Israel grew and grew. We see others leaving. Rabbi Bartanura left Italy. Bartanura, you all know Bartanura, to settle in Jerusalem. And eventually in the Spanish expulsion of 1492, this exploded Jews from Spain all around the world. Literally all around the world. North America, South America were beginning to open up. Europe, and of course, Eretz Israel, to which they were attracted by the community which was largely Sephardi in Sfat. Sfat, we'll talk a lot about Sfat. Sfat was the hub of Eretz Israel at that point. Sfat was a very major Jewish center for a few reasons. Number one, because the Ottomans invaded Israel in 1516. Now, we always think about the Ottomans in some ways, you know, black and white terms, as there's the good guys and the bad guys, and were they the good guys or the bad guys? The answer is, at the beginning, they were the good guys. Meaning the Jewish community in Eretz Israel strongly supported the Ottomans in their attempt to conquer Eretz Israel, because they felt that they would be much better for the Jews than the Mamluks, which were an Islamic group before them, which were much more Harif, much more fundamentalist. And indeed, that proved to be the case. The Ottomans were relatively, everything's relative, benign to the Jewish communities through their 300-400 years in Eretz Israel. Of course, towards the end of their Ottoman Empire, this was the beginning of Zionism, and it was a whole different world. But at the beginning in 1516, Zionism was a long way away. But what the Ottomans did is they opened up Israel to the whole Ottoman Empire. Instead of being a tiny little backwater of a Mamluk territory, it now became part of an empire, and it was joined with Syria in the north, with Egypt in the south, and Jews began to travel around. The trade routes went through Tzfat, the Jews were attracted to the trade, and Tzfat became a significant Jewish community, also because of the Kvarim of the Tanaim, particularly Rashbi, of Shimon Bar Yochai, we've still got the echoes of Lag BaOmer in our ears, so because of Rashbi, Tzfat also became a very important centre for the Jews as well. So the Jews were settled largely in Tzfat, and then the big news, if you like, at the beginning of the 16th century was Rav Yaakov Beirav, which we'll talk about in a minute, left Egypt, settled in Tzfat, and established a large yeshiva in Tzfat, and that was really the beginning of the major Torah movement in Tzfat, which we'll talk about soon. That's a little historical context. In biographical terms, Rav Yosef Karo was born in Spain in 1488. He was expelled with his family as a small child, as a four-year-old. Interesting to think what effect that would have had on him as a four-year-old. He fled to Portugal, and he was expelled from there as well in 1497 when he was a nine-year-old. So he would obviously experience firsthand the Girush from Sfarad and then from Portugal. He studied in Egypt for a number of years. His father was a Talmud Chacham of renown, as was his uncle. He studied in Egypt under Yaakov Beirav. Rav Yaakov Beirav, we talked about before, when he was still in Egypt. He then moved to Turkey, and he had a very important meeting, if you like, and a connection with Shlomo Molcho. Shlomo Molcho was a false messiah who was extremely popular and very, very inspirational before Shabtai Tzvi. This was already 150 years before Shabtai Tzvi, but Shlomo Molcho was much more, if you like, of the real deal as far as the Jews were concerned than Shabtai Tzvi turned out to be, although they believed in him very much at the beginning. But Molcho was burnt at the stake by the Christians. It says he was burnt in Germany here, but actually he was tried in Germany. He was burnt in Mantua in Italy. And the experience that Rav Yosef Karo had with Shlomo Molcho really switched something on inside him that made him very much more of a mystic. And it was after he met Shlomo Molcho that he began to receive the voice of the Maggid, which we'll talk about soon how that worked. And he also began to work on his major halachic magnum opus, the Beit Yosef, which we'll examine in detail. The journeys of Rav Yosef Karo took him to Turkey. He became close to Kabbalists, Rav Yosef Tetazak, and Rav Shlomo Levi Alkabet. Rav Shlomo Levi Alkabet, of course, is famous for having written, famous to us, anyway, for having written Lahadavi. I was once asked by my son, this is as an aside, when my son was about 8 years old, he turned around to me in Shul on Friday night and he said, "I don't understand, why does it say Shamor v'zachor v'dibur echad?" At the beginning of Lahadodi, that we learned in school that the Chazal say Zachor v'Shamor v'Dibarakat. Why is it different here? So I looked at him and I said, well, it was written by Shlomo HaLevi Alkabet. He wrote his name at the front. His name was not Zlomo, it was Shlomo. If he'd been called Zlomo, he would have written it like it says in the Gemara. I remember the look on his face, a look of complete rejection. And he said, "This is the best you can do. You know, you're meant to be my father, my teacher, Shlomo and Shlomo." It was a moment when the parent realizes they've lost a certain something in the eyes of their child. I said, "Okay, I'll try and find you a better answer." And there are deep Kabbalistic answers which I frankly didn't understand, but that's brought down as well. But Shlomo HaLevi Alkabet, and they became very close, they learned together, eventually they were in Israel together. In 1535, following the instruction of the Maggid to make Aliyah, Rav Yosef Karo moved to Tzfat. He was appointed to the Beit Din of Rav Yaakov Beirav, He supported the establishment of smicha. We'll talk about what that is in a minute. And he gave it, he received the smicha, gave it to his students. He completed the Beis Yosef, which we'll again go into. When Rav Yaakov Beis Rav died, he became the head of the Tzfat Beit Din, which was really a world famous Beit Din, and he received questions from all over the world, including from Poland, from Rav Moshe Itzlis, who we'll talk about soon as well. And through the end of his life, he had a very long life. He died at the age of late 80s, which was very unusual in those days. He published Beis Yosef, and then the Shulchan Aruch, and then the Kesef Mishnah on the Rambam, and he died eventually at a very old age, on the 13th of Nisan, just before Pesach, and was buried in Tzfat. And you can go see his grave in Tzfat today. He married a number of times. He had three wives. His earlier two wives died. And he had two surviving sons, one born very early, and one born when he was already in his 80s. So the sons were probably decades and decades apart, but he left that family, and I've brought you a little bit more about him at the bottom. That was, in a nutshell, his life. He was not in Yerushalayim, no.
Never?
No, I can't tell you that he never came to Yerushalayim, but he certainly was not based in Yerushalayim, he was based in Tzfat. The works of the Rav Yosef Karo are as follows. The Beis Yosef, which we'll talk about soon, in fact we'll maybe talk about now a little bit. The Beis Yosef was his magnum opus. It was a commentary on the Torah. The Torah was one of the major halachic codes written by Rav Yaakov ben Harosh, around 100 or so years earlier, 150 years earlier. In the Beis Yosef, we'll see what he did, we'll read the introduction soon. He collected all of the commentaries that we'll see why he felt he had to do this, up until his day, and he put them together in a commentary on the Torah. It took him 20 years to complete, and then he spent 12 years reviewing it, and it was published towards the end of his life. As I said, the Beis Yosef really is one of the main go-to works of people studying halacha today. He brings together all of the major commentaries, but then he bases his tzak, and this is what we'll see was controversial, on the Rif, the Rambam, and the Rosh. And we'll see how he did this, and why this was not altogether accepted. Later on, he produced a kitzur version, a shortened version of the Beis Yosef, where he just gave the bottom line halachic answers to the questions, which he called the Shulchan Aruch, the laid out table, which he wanted to put without sources and without all of the argumentation. He actually published it in 30 parts, so you could review one part of Shulchan Aruch every single day of the month, and you could review Shulchan Aruch every single month. I don't know if anybody these days goes through the entire Shulchan Aruch every month. I have a copy of the Shulchan Aruch on my shelf, which is divided in that way, which sits on my shelf, probably more in hope than expectation, but you can buy it divided in that way. There was significant opposition, we'll see, to the Shulchan Aruch from a number of sources, particularly the Ashkenazim, and we'll talk about why that was. The Shulchan Aruch, of course, now has spawned its own commentaries, key commentaries like the Magen Avraham and the Taz and the Shach, and the Chelkis Mechokik and others that I've written here, and then later commentaries through the 18th, 19th century, including up until the Vilna Gaon, the Mishnah Berurah, Bir Halacha, from our 20th century. Also, the Shulchan Aruch gave people the idea to produce other Shulchan Aruchs later, mini summaries, if you like, of the Halacha, of which I've just mentioned three famous ones, the Shulchan Aruch Harav, which came around 150 years later, 200 years later, which was by the Alter Rebbe, the first Rebbe in Lubavitch, okay? Which if you go to a Lubavitch home, you'll see on the shelf something that says on it, Shulchan Aruch. It's quite likely to be the Shulchan Aruch Harav. There's probably another Shulchan Aruch of Rav Yosef Karo, but the Shulchan Aruch Harav became very famous. The Chai Adam, which became also in the 18th century very famous, and the Kitzur Shulchan Aruch in the 19th century, which again, these were all different books written by different people, but all with the same idea of summarizing the halakha in the way that the Rav Yosef Karo did. And finally, towards the end of his life, he wrote a commentary on the Rambam, the Kesef Mishnah, in addition to many responsa and the Maggid Meshorim, which we'll talk about, and other books which we've lost. He wrote a commentary on Rashi, which is referred to, but we've lost, and we don't know where it is, and hopefully we'll find it one day. Now, that is like the first 15 minutes is a biographical historical background, which will give us the tools, if you like, that we need to understand. The big debate of his life was what I called here the Great Smicha Debate. And it's based off this Rambam. Look at the Rambam in number 2. The Rambam says here, bottom of page 2, Nir Lihadvarim said, it seems to me, says the Rambam,
She'im hiskimu kol hachachamim she'be'eretz Yisrael.
If all the rabbis in Israel were to agree, okay? And by the way, the proportion say doesn't mean all, he means most. You're never going to get everyone to agree.
Lemanot dayanim, and they want to then appoint dayanim, velismochatam, and to give them smicha. And by smicha, he's not talking about what we today call smicha. Smicha today is a certificate given by your rabbi to say you've learnt enough halacha to be let loose on the unsuspecting public. And basically, usually they hand out the smicha with the phone number of the rabbi saying, if you have a shaila, call me. And that's how it works. Smicha today is very dependent on who gave it and what it's in, etc. To say today I have smicha means nothing at all. It depends who gave you smicha, what did you study it in, how did you study it, etc. But there was an original smicha, which was the smicha of the Sanhedrin, which was lost. That smicha from Moshe Rabbeinu down allowed a person, a man, to sit on the Sanhedrin and be done dine knasot and dine nefashot, capital crimes, corporal issues, etc. That is the smicha that the Rambam is talking about, that can be restarted again if just the rabbis of Israel get together and agree. Okay? Hare elu smuchim, and then these new people will be real smuchim, they will have smicha. V'yesh lehen ladun dine knasot, and then they can do all the things they need to do that the real Sanhedrin can do. V'yesh lehen lismuch l'acharim, and they can give smicha to others. V'im kein, if that's the case of the Rambam, lama hayu chachamim itzdarim ha-smicha, why were the rabbis so upset that we lost smicha? Kidei shelo yivatlu dine knasot mi'Yisrael, that we no longer had the ability to have a full Sanhedrin. What was the problem? If what I'm saying is true, says the Rambam, they could have easily restarted smicha at any time. Why were they upset? And he says, Lefisha Yisrael mufuzarim, because the Jews were too scattered. They just couldn't agree. Meaning, what stopped us from having a Sanhedrin? Politics and the geopolitical reality of the Jews being scattered. Now, today, there is no longer a geopolitical problem. The Jews are all together, and if they're not physically together, they're just on a piece of plastic, and everyone's connected. But the politics is still an issue. So they couldn't agree. Ve'im hayasham samach nifi samach. If we only have someone with smicha going all the way down unbroken, ain't a tzarich dat kulam. We don't need to get them to agree. Aradam din iknosus lekol shiharin nismach nifi beitim. But he's not sure, and at the end he leaves it v'hadava tzarich hachra, which for the Rambam is unusual. The Rambam is very confident. He gives the halacha as it is. He says this, and he doesn't falter. And yet in this halacha he started niran li hadvarim. I think, meaning he's not getting this from a clear source. And at the end of this halacha, he writes, v'hadava tzarech hachra. I'm not 100% sure. So he already leaves it as a bit of a question. But according to the Rambam, in principle, you can restart the Sanhedrin. We could do that tomorrow morning. There is a group of people today called the Sanhedrin. Okay, they're not the Sanhedrin, because they haven't been accepted by Klal Yisrael, but they have a website, I suppose that's a good start. And they're great people, they're just not accepted by the population as a whole. But there have been attempts to restart the Sanhedrin many times. Here we'll see Rav Yaakov Beirav made an attempt. There were attempts later. Napoleon put together something he called the Sanhedrin. And when the state of Israel was also created, there were high hopes that there would be a Sanhedrin. Okay, and therefore the Rambam is the basis for this possibility. And of course, putting together a Sanhedrin has massive implications. It would mean we can reopen the debates of the Gemara. Things that are sealed up until now, but can be unsealed and revisited once we have a Sanhedrin to readdress these questions, and therefore that is something which is very exciting. And it doesn't have to be Mashiach. We don't have to have Mashiach in order to have a Sanhedrin. On the contrary, we probably need the Sanhedrin before Mashiach, and therefore the Rambam is a very useful halacha. The Bet Yosef, over the page please, in his commentary on Choshen Mishpat, follows the Rambam's step. The Bet Yosef himself quotes the Rambam, and I'm not going to read it through again because it's basically the words of the Rambam, and he says, I agree that the Rambam's halacha is the halacha, and we can restart a Sanhedrin if we want. In his own life, there was a major attempt to do this. Have a look, please, on page 3. The Ottoman invasion of Eretz Yisrael was almost messianic for people. Together with, and coming so close after, the Girush Misparad, which was their Holocaust experience, the Jews were traumatized. To be then, a few years later, given the Ottoman invasion, which is very reminiscent in many ways of what we've experienced in the 20th century, of the Holocaust being followed so quickly by this new hope of a Jewish presence in Eretz Israel, of what we have as Medina, the equivalent in those days was this experience. The Ottomans coming in, people really thought was going to open up something new. And the Kabbalists of Sfat started to really develop this messianic feeling, to the point that Rabbi Yaakov the Rav in 1538 called together a convocation of rabbis and said, we're going to restart the Smicha. Based on the Rambam, we'll get the majority together. Sfat was the hub, and they gave Smicha to a number of people, including Rabbi Yosef Karo, the real Smicha, okay? The Mavit, Rav Moshe Trani, and other people. Rabbi Levi ibn Chaviv was living in Yerushalayim, and they sent a Smicha to him too. And they said, look, you know, this Smicha, you are worthy of the Smicha. He sent it back and said, I don't want your Smicha, and you can't start the Smicha because we don't agree. And the rabbis of Yerushalayim have to be in on it. To which the rabbis of Sfat said, so come in. And they said, no, we don't agree. The rabbis of Yerushalayim, of course, are in Yerushalayim, and Yerushalayim is HaKodesh, but Yerushalayim was very much a minor player in those days compared to Sfat. It's interesting how these things work. 400 years before that, when the Ramban was here, Yerushalayim was also empty, and Akko was the place where all the Jews lived. It's interesting to see, you can think of Akko, who goes to Akko today, it's very nice, but it's not seen as a major Jewish hub. So in these days it was Sfat. So the rabbis of Yerushalayim were very unhappy. They wrote to Rav Dovid ibn Zimra, the Radvaz in Egypt, and said, you've got to weigh in on this, and he also came in against. And basically the whole project ground to a halt. When Rav Yaakov Bey Rav died, it basically ended. There were flickers, for example, the Ottomans gave Severia to Donna Gracia Mendes, and her nephew, Don Yosef Nasi, and therefore there was a Jewish town for the first time in Eretz Israel, for the first time in thousands of years. People really felt this was very exciting, but ultimately the project faltered, and the last person to have this smicha, Rav Chaim Vital, who was a student of the Arizal, he died in 1620, and then nothing else was heard of it until today. So the Bet Yosef, Rav Yosef Karo, lived with this, if you like, disappointment, that the smicha project that he so believed in, and the Magid told him was approved in Shamayim, we'll see that in a minute, it never happened. And therefore, in many ways, you can see the Shulchan Aruch as his, if you like, response to the failure of the Smicha program, and we'll see why that is right now. Now, let's talk about the Bet Yosef. The Jewish people, halachically, were in real trouble in the beginning of the 1500s. And let me tell you why. If you took a snapshot of the Jewish people in the year, let's say, 1200, everything's a fairly settled picture. The Jews in northern France live in northern France, and they know who their rabbis are, they follow Rashi and Tosafot, etc. The Jews in Spain, they know who their people are, and they follow the Rambam, etc. And the Jews in Iraq and Babel, everybody lived in relatively stable scenarios in which they've been for the last 400 or 500 years. People davened in shuls that their relatives had davened in for 400 or 500 years. It was a stable picture. 200 years later, by the 1400s, that whole stability was completely destroyed. For various reasons. First of all, the total breakdown of the Jewish community in Spain, which was the lead Jewish community of the world, and their final explosion around the world. So by 1500, the Jews in Spain were everywhere. And there was no longer a clear Masorah. At the same time, the Ashkenazim, between, let's say, 1300 and 1500, were being pushed from place to place to place to place. Now is not the time to go through the maps, but if you follow the communities as they moved around Europe, they often went back and forth many times until they were thrown out again by the Christian rulers. The Ashkenazi communities were in total disarray. They were dispossessed after the Black Death, after the plague in the 1350s. There was enormous amounts of hatred towards the Jews because they blamed the Jews for the Black Death. And there were pogroms, etc. And the Jews felt they had to move. And the only real place that they could move, where they weren't going around in circles, was east. What was to the east? No man's land. Pagan countries that no one had really heard of, much like Lithuania and Russia and Poland. Places where they were still literally worshipping trees in the 1300s. The Jews went there. And they welcomed them with open arms. Because they said, look, these people, they're civilized, they come from Europe, and they bring with them money and trade, etc. So the Jews, if anyone in this room has grandparents, great-grandparents who ended up or came from Poland, Lithuania, Russia, etc., the chances are this is when they went there in the 1400s, 1300s, 1400s, 1500s. Now, what does that mean for halakha? It meant that no one had clarity in Masorah. By the 1500s, people couldn't say, oh, this is what my grandfather did, this is what my great-grandfather did. They weren't in anymore in that situation of stability. And in any one town, there were Jews from everywhere. There were Jews, take a town in Dalmatia, somewhere like Split, or something like that. It was, some of them were Sephardim, some of them were Ashkenazim, some of them were North African, some of them were this, some of them were German, French. Everybody was everywhere. And therefore, the Bet Yosef felt that something needs to be done for this. And this is why he created the Bet Yosef. Why did he call it the Bet Yosef? What was the house of Yosef? The house of Yosef was a house of refuge for the Jewish people, for the brothers in Egypt. I'll protect you, said Yosef to the brothers, says the Bet Yosef, and I'll protect you. Come to my book and you'll be okay. And this is what he did. And let's read a little bit from his introduction in page 3, and we'll see how he did this. I brought you here the introduction to the Bet Yosef, and let's read this. I'm not going to read the whole thing, but let's skip around a little bit. Al-Chein ani Adal ba'al-Pi. I am, who am I, he says, Yosef, I'm Moreno Rav Ephraim, the Moreno Rav Yosef, okay, his grandfather was of Yosef, Cairo. The word Cairo is not Cairo, by the way, he never went to Cairo, as far as I'm aware. Maybe he did, he was in Egypt, but Cairo is from the word Yakar, meaning precious. In Spanish today, Cairo means expensive or precious. Okay? Kineti la'ashem tevakot. I have decided, I am zealous for God. I'm going to pave a new path. So he's counting the Chavet Sefer. I'm going to write a book, he said. I'm going to explain all the roots of all the dinim and what's I'm not going to leave anything out. And then he says, I didn't want to write a book on its own. I decided to write it as a perush on something else. I initially, he says, thought I would write it on the Rambam. But then I decided, no, the Rambam's not so helpful, because the Rambam only brings one opinion, his opinion, whereas the Tur, he said, is more useful, because he already brings multiple opinions in the Tur, and therefore I already have a running start that I can add to all of these things. Go to the second paragraph. So anyone who has my book in front of them, will have in front of him, very well organized, the words of the Talmud, him, and then he gives his list of svarim. Peirush Rashi, Tosfos, Ram, Pisya, Rif, Rosh, Mordechai, Ram, and he goes on. And he lists 30 or so svarim that he's collected. He was an amazing researcher. He put together all of these svarim, and he said, on every single halachic practical issue, I will give you everyone's opinion, and then I will come to a psak. We'll see how that works in a minute. In the third paragraph, he makes an apology, which I will mention now, because it becomes important. He says, and I want this to be for everybody, including Ashkenazim. He says, and please don't be upset with me if I bring more Sephardim than Ashkenazim, because at the end of the day, the Ashkenazi poskim all pretty much say the same thing on a lot of issues. They all follow Tosfos. So please don't be choshed me. Please don't suspect me when I left out some of the Ashkenazim. He knew, I think, that this was going to be an issue, and it became an issue. He says, I brought you a lot of different people, including Ashkenazim, but I've summarized the Ashkenazi stack in shorter terms. And then he says, how am I going to rule? How am I going to rule in Pesach? So if you look down at the bottom of the page, and number 4, and on bottom of page 3, he says the following. Ulechein hiskamti bedati, ki liot shloshet amudei ha-hora. What are the three pillars of Pesach? Hashe ha-bayit beit Yisrael nish'an aleihem, bahorateihem. Who do we rest upon in Pesach? Haloheim, who are they? Harif, v'harambam, v'harosh. Now, the Rif was a Rav in North Africa in the 11th century, in Karawan, and then later in Morocco. The Rambam, you know who the Rambam was. He was a Rav in Spain and then Egypt in the 12th century. And the Rosh was in the 13th century, and he started off in Germany, the Rosh, and he was one of the students of the Maharam of Rottenberg, who was from the tradition of the Tosafot and the Ashkenazim. I'm sure he's well known. The Maharam of Rottenberg was captured by the German Christians and imprisoned and ransomed to the Jewish people, and he refused to accept the ransom. The Jewish people raised the money, and the Maharam said, no, under no circumstances would you pay the money, and he died imprisoned. And the Rosh, his students, saw the writing on the wall and said, this is it, the Jews, it's finished for the Jews in Europe, we have to get out of here. And he went to Spain, and he became an extremely popular posek in Spain. And therefore, the Rosh himself was, if you like, a crossover figure. So the Rif, the Rambam, and the Rosh, so which of them are Sephardi and which of them are Ashkenazi? So the Rif is Sephardi through and through. The Rambam is more Sephardi than the Sephardi. And the Rosh He was Ashkenazi, but he lived in Spain, and we'll see he was seen as being a Sephardi Pesach. And therefore, these are the three he said that I'm going to use. How's he going to do that? Amarti alibi shebamakim sheh shnayim mehem maskimim ledat achat. When two of them agree on a psak, nifsek halacha kamosam, we'll paskin like that. In order to make that makomish, we call chachmi Israel or rubam cholkim. And therefore, that's his position. I'm going to take, he says, the majority of these three. The Rif, the Rambam, and the Rosh. If I get three out of three, then that's like, you know, when you're in Vegas, not that I've ever been to Vegas, but the cherries all come up and the money comes out, jackpot, okay? Three out of three, that's the halacha. Two out of three, also I'll pass them like that, because you know, follow the majority. Achrei Ravim Lahachos, it's a Jewish halachic principle to follow the majority. Two out of three. If only one, I can only find one and everyone's disagreeing, he says, then I'll go and try and put together a consensus from all the others for him, but if I can use those three, I'll use those three. Just go over the page, please. And then he finishes off, and he says, the last little paragraph on the top, page 4, the im ksat asos nagu issa b'ksat dvarim, if there are people who are more machmir than my psak, more stricter than my psak, apotisha an nachriya behefech, yechdichu mimin agam, they should keep their chumras, and I'm not coming here to tell you to be lenient, but if you are machmir in an area, then, you know, good on you, and you should keep doing that. But by implication, he said, but if you're lenient, and I brought out my book, and that's my sack, then you've got to fall in line with my sack. I'm making a sack to bind everybody. Ashkenazim, Sfaradim, because we need it. We're all so fragmented, and we have no clarity of Metzora, and I'm putting together a book for everybody. And I brought you a comment here in number 5 from Professor Tashma, from an academic perspective, and he says, interestingly, the book really is a blend. He says, qualitatively, by nature of halachic decision and outlook, the book was Sephardic. Though quantitatively, by the number of decisions and customs quoted, the book was Ashkenazic. In its general approach to halacha and structure, the book was certainly Sephardic in tradition, but in detail and particular decisions, the book was reflective of Ashkenazic traditions. And therefore, he does really try very hard to blend the two, Sephardi and Ashkenazi, and he does want to be accepted. And he is worried that he won't be accepted, as we see from the Maggid, which is constantly telling him, don't worry, because you will be accepted, and we'll get to the Maggid right now, okay? But the Bet Yosef was for sure his magnum opus, really nothing like it had ever been done before. In its scale, in its quality, in its depth, it was a book which really took over the world. And by the way, the Hashkocha had it that the printing press had been invented only a few decades before this, and the one printing press in Eretz Yisrael was in Tzfat, down the road. And therefore, for the first time really in Jewish history, someone could write a sefer, and it was on the desk printed of pretty much every rav in the world within a few decades. This had never happened before, and therefore that was also responsible for his success. Now, that's a little bit about the Bet Yosef. Who and what is this Maggid, which I've mentioned so many times? The story of the Maggid began sometime after Shlomo Malka was burnt at the stake. And it started on the Tikkun Leil Shavuot. Tikkun Leil Shavuot was instigated actually not in Tzfat, although that's what they tell you when you go talking around Tzfat, but it was instituted in Chutz La'aretz, in Turkey and in Bulgaria, where he lived for a while. And at a certain point on Tikkun Leil, the voice started speaking to him, and Rav Shlomo Levi Alkevetz claims that he and many others heard this voice. A voice coming through whatever, out to speak to the Rav Yosef Karo during Tikkun Leil Shavuot. And he writes down notes, almost like his diaries, of a stream of consciousness of how the voice speaks to him for 40 years. And he calls it the voice of the Mishnah. He calls it the Matronita. He calls it the female voice. The voice sometimes speaks as a male voice, as a female voice. And he wrote it up in the Maggid Meisharim. I've listed here some of the interesting messages that he got from the Maggid. Okay? One of them, it tells him he should study Mishnah diligently. He told him to move to Eretz Israel, and he did. He told him he would be a preeminent leader of world Jewry, and he was. He told him that even though he doubted himself, that his track was accurate and halacha l'moshe m'Sinai, it actually told him, apparently, that he should finish his book quickly, because there's a rabbi in Poland who's trying to do the same thing. That was a piece of useful advice, as we'll see soon. It taught him how to achieve Gilu Eliyahu. It gave him ethical instruction. It taught him Kabbalistic explanations, etc. It told him that his smicha project was blessed in Shamayim. And it told him that he would die as a martyr like Shlomo Molchon, which he did not. He died an old man peacefully. Actually, he died while he was writing a tshuva. And on the bottom of the page, his son wrote that my father would have written the tshuva, but he died in the middle. Interestingly. But a very old man. The question is, how do we relate to this maggid? Is this something that we feel is helps us have confidence in Rabbi Yosef Karo? Or do we look at this from 20th century, 21st century perspectives as a little bit strange? Like, do I really want the world's halakhic authority to be someone who's hearing voices and writing them down? And actually, in the Bet Yosef, he really keeps the two quite distinct. We'll see that how that works in a minute. And he doesn't engage in Kabbalistic and mystical discussions. He keeps it very tight in the Bet Yosef, and he clearly wears his rabbi hat, if you like, rather than his mystic hat, which he writes in the Magid Meisharim. But everybody attested to the fact that this was very, very much part of his life. I saw yesterday, I didn't put it on the sheet because I only found it yesterday, a long essay by Rachel Elior. I don't know if people know Rachel Elior. She is an academic and an authority on Chassidut. And she writes a very long article about actually how this book, the Magid Meisharim, was an enormous influence on whom? On the Baal Shem Tov. When the Baal Shem Tov was putting together 100 years later, 150 years later, his ideas about Chassidut, the Magid Meisharim is one of the main base texts that influenced the Baal Shem Tov, the Besht, and therefore all of Chassidus. Therefore, it could well be that the Magid Meisharim and the Magid itself has influenced the Jewish world through Chassidus in a way that perhaps he didn't realize, in the same way that the Besht Yosef has influenced the world in Halacha. The other big issue at the time was the Zohar. The Zohar, I'm not getting into a whole discussion now about where did the Zohar come from and why was it unknown for 1,000 years, but by the 13th, 14th century, the Zohar was beginning to creep out, but it had not yet been printed. And Rav Yosef Karo was one of the first people, really, to bring the Zohar as one of the opinions in the Bet Yosef. Again, he really separates the two to a large degree, but he claims that the Zohar is definitely authoritative. He doesn't always rule like the Zohar, by the way, clearly. Sometimes the Zohar says to me very, very specifically, like, eating meat after milk. The Zohar very explicitly says that if you eat meat after milk in the same meal, then all sorts of terrible things will happen. Okay? And the Bet Yosef doesn't pass in that way. He rules, as we pass in Halacha, that if you ate milk, you're allowed to eat meat afterwards, just not the other way around. So he doesn't always rule like the Zohar, but nevertheless he includes the Zohar as one of his main texts. And this is very important because this really introduced some of these Kabbalistic ideas into... What language? It's written in Hebrew. It's written in Hebrew. I assume it was speaking to him in Hebrew. Okay, but the Magid Meisharim is written in Hebrew, that's for sure. Have a look at some examples. Go over onto page 5 for a second. Here's one interesting example of how the Kabbalah can impact on the Halakha and what happens if there's a conflict. The issue at stake here is when you get called up to the Torah, if a man gets called up from Elias to the Torah and makes the brachas, should he then quietly say the Leinin together with the Baal Kriya? Now, originally, as I'm sure you're aware, there didn't used to be a Baal Kriya. And the Teimanim do it this way today. If you get called up in a Teimani shul, you better know what you're doing. Because they expect that you're not just going to make a bracha, but you're going to do the Leinin as well. And if you can't, then they'll, Nebuch Ashkenazim, and they'll call up a kid and he'll do it instead. Okay? And then you'll feel like a right Charlie. But the principle is, why does the halacha say that the person who has been called up has to read with them? Because they made the brachas. Now that they're no longer the person reading, they have to at least do something. You can't make a bracha and then somebody else read. Look at number 6. When we talk Rosh and Harosh, this is taken from the Bet Yosef. Shekata Rabbeinu, Yitzvah Lecha Shitzarech Ha'ala Likrot Benachat. That the person who comes up has to read quietly. Im Shliach Tzibur. Im Shliach Tzibur, meaning the Baal Kriya. Kedesh Shaloi Tzei Brikata Levatala. Otherwise, his bracha is a bracha levatala. Hashem bachavanu mikol amim. And then someone else learns Torah. V'rabbeinu ha-gadol mahariyah v'uhav. We quote here. Katav shemati shekata b'teva ha-zohar. He now brings the Kabbalistic stack of the Zohar. She'en mikrot klal. That he's not allowed to read. Ela echad. V'ruy lachush v'svarav. That the Zohar has a Kabbalistic problem. That if more than one person reads, that's a mystical problem. I don't know why. But that's a mystical problem. You can't have it. And therefore you have a clash between the Zohar and the Poskim. But Kevan Shalidibe has Zohar Osalikra, Ela Echadabad. And since the Zohar says only one person can read, the Akshav Shinad was Shlech Sibu Hu Hakorah. Okay? And now that we have one person reading, meaning the Shlech Sibu who called us to read, Ha'oile Osalikra. He paskens that the one who comes up is offered to read. Afal Pisha Dibre HaPoskim Tarekos, even though the other classic poskim say he must read, the in lo yikra kosm with the Havi Brachal of Atala, me'acha sheloi nizka zeba talmud, here's the important principle, says the Bet Yosef, since this halacha that the person called up must read was not mentioned in the Talmud, behavior explicitly, lo shakin and Dibre HaZohar mipnei Dibre HaPoskim. If there's a clash between the Zohar and the poskim, not the Gemara, the Zohar wins, says the Bet Yosef, and therefore I'm going to paskin that the person who is called up must not read together with the Baal Kora, because it's a clash between the Zohar and the poskim win. On this issue, the Zohar wins, correct, I'm just testing, okay? The Zohar wins. If it's a conflict between the Zohar and the Talmud, he says, okay, the Talmud has to win. But that's largely, he says, in number 7, because people don't really know the Zohar, and it's Rav Shimon Bar Yochai, and maybe we wouldn't paskin like him anyway. But in principle, the Zohar versus the poskim, the Zohar wins. Why? Because the Zohar, he says, is from Tanaim. It's from a Shimon Bar Yochai. And the poskim, the Rosh and the Rambam, etc., they're later. And that you can't compare the two. On this point, we need to bring in now and introduce the Ramah, Rav Moshe Isser. Rav Moshe Isserles was living in Poland. He was the rabbi in Poland who the Maggid was telling Rav Yosef Karo is on the same track. Basically, what was Ramon doing? He had the same problem. He woke up and he said, look, we're living in the 16th century. We cannot go on like we did before. We need a book to bind everything together. And he started work on exactly the same project that Bet Yosef was working on in Svat and before in Turkey. The story goes that the Ramah found out about the Bet Yosef that he beat into it when one of the students of the Ramah gave the Ramah a copy of the Bet Yosef as a gift and said, look, Rebbe, you like this, it's your kind of thing. To which he read it and he realized that his whole life work was basically already finished by somebody else. At that point, he had a brainwave. He said he was quite depressed at the beginning about this, obviously. He's been beaten to the finishing line. But then he decided, actually, here's something, this could be an opportunity. Let's use this as a positive, not a negative. And he wrote to the Rav Yosef Karo and said, look, I'm in the middle of working on something the same as you. Let's team forces, let's come together, make a team, okay? Team together and produce something which is better for the collaboration. And we'll see what that ended up like. But on this particular point, the Darchei Moshe comes in immediately, number 8, and says as follows. Look at number 8. The Ein Lazuz Midivri HaPoskim. He says, no, I don't agree. A clash between the Zohar and the Poskim, the Zohar cannot win. The Poskim must win. Af Im Hanu Divri HaZohu Cholkim Aleihem. And even though the Zohar goes against the Poskim have to win. When it's a clash between Nigla and Nisar, then Nigla, the revealed Torah, has to win. And this was one of the points on which the Bet Yosef disagreed with the Ramah, on how strongly are we going to bring in the Zohar as a real powerhouse in Halacha, and the Bet Yosef, as a mystic as well, pushed this a little bit more, and the Ramah, who was, by the way, also a Kabbalist, but a different kind of Kabbalist, he was less enthusiastic. I brought you a number 9 and 10, the modern postgame, bring this as a test case, if you like. How do we deal with the conflict between the Zohar, between the mystical sources and the non-mystical sources? And the Mishnah Berurah gives various different guidelines here, which I'm not getting into now because I won't have enough time, but you can read number 9 and number 10 at your leisure. Another issue, by the way, which comes up, is wearing tefillin on Chol HaMoed. From a mystical perspective, wearing tefillin on Chol HaMoed is a big no-no. You cannot do that. As I'm sure people are aware, in Eretz Yisrael, the minhag in Halacha is very clearly like the Gro, who passed in the mystical sack and said no tefillin on Chol HaMoed. Even, and that's what the Rav Yosef Karo rules, because the Zohar has some very negative things to say about someone who wears tefillin on Chol HaMoed, whereas the Ramah brings down the basic sack of the poskim, just as we've seen before, and says, no, Chol HaMoed, you wear tefillin. You don't make a bracha, but you wear tefillin. And if anybody from Chutz La'aretz has ever made the mistake, like I did when I first got married, of putting on my tefillin on Chol HaMoed, In Eretz Yisrael, when I was here on vacation, they practically lifted me off the chair and threw me out of the building. Because the psak is very, very strong here, even though in Chutz La'aretz, truth is, in Chutz La'aretz, mishmash. Half the people wear tefillin, half the people don't wear tefillin, which is a problem in and of itself, but that's another example of this. Turn over, please, to page 6. Let's talk just a little bit, just to mention about the Ramah, and then we'll talk about the reception to the Shulchan Aruch. The Ramah lived in Poland, as I mentioned. He was one of the first generations coming to Poland. The Jews had been gradually slipping into Poland over the 100, 200 years before. I brought you some information. He was a student and a son-in-law of Shalom Schachner, who was one of the greats of Ashkenazi Poland at that point. He was much younger than the Vetchester. Even though he wrote to him and collaborated with him, he was a good 40 years younger than the Vetchester, and he lived a relatively short life. He died at the age of 42 here in Krakow. He died in Lag BaOmer, actually. And he had a very difficult life, although he funded the yeshiva. His wife and his mother and his grandmother died all close together. If you've ever been to the Ramah Shul in Poland, in Krakow, I'm sure people have visited, it's worth visiting. He made that shul in honor of his mother and his wife and his grandmother, who all passed away. He himself was a great Talmudist and a Kabbalist and a keen philosopher and an astronomer, and I brought you a list of his works on the bottom, the most important of which for our purposes is this issue of his response to the Shulchan Aruch. So let's talk now for the last 15 minutes of the shiur about how the Beit Yosef was received and how the Shulchan Aruch was received. Because, as I mentioned at the beginning, the Shulchan Aruch was a summary sefer of the Beit Yosef. And he set it out on practical halacha, and he said, look, people need a nice straightforward book to follow and to review, and the Ramah wrote to him and said, look, we need to just include a bit more Ashkenazi stuff, we'll see that in a minute, and together they put together the Shulchan Aruch. The responses were varied. The early responses were mostly quite negative. The Sfarim as well were not happy. Look at number 12. This is from one of the students of the Mabit, and the Alshich, who was part of the Bet Midrash of Rabbi Yosef Karo. He says, in writing in the Tshuva, shortly after the Shulchan Aruch came out, he writes to the person who passed him this halacha, he made a big mistake. Why did you make a mistake? Ki hu ra b'Shulchan Aruch, because you saw it in the Shulchan Aruch. You can't use that book in a tshuva. How dare you, he said. That book was written for children and Amei Haaretz. Now, it sounds a bit rude, but in fairness, the Shulchan Aruch writes in his own introduction, I've written this book for children to help them in their work who can't manage the Beit Yosef, and for people who can't do all the Talmudic thinking. But at the end of the day, people were nervous about the Shulchan Aruch initially. The main posek for the Sfardim was the Rosh. And I brought you here Rabbi Yosef Ibn Levi, number 13, who says, Nahagu al pi harosh, ki hu achron haposkim shevet Sfarad. Which is interesting, because the Rosh was the Ashkenazi of the Rif Rambam Rosh, and yet he was the posek of Sfarad. And actually, Rabbi Yosef Ibn Levi was very nervous to use the Sefer. The Chidah brings a beautiful story. The Chidah, a couple of hundred years later, says the following. Look at number 40. The Chidah wrote a book in the late 1700s called Shem Gedolim, where he writes stories about great people from the past. And he said, when the Beit Yosef first came out, there's lacking in Bekiyut. It's not really worth using. But Gazar al-Talmidav, he made a ruling on his Talmidim, Shelo Yalamduba, they're not allowed to learn the Beit Yosef. It's a cheap sefer, he says. It's the art scroll of the time. No, I wouldn't be down on art scroll. Art scroll write wonderful books. But you know how it is. Sometimes when you go in a yeshiva and you pull out an art scroll Gemara, the Rosh Yeshiva will say, no, you cannot use an art scroll Gemara in my Beit Midrash. It's cheating. You have to go through the zip or go to the gym and pay someone else to lift up the weights for you and saying, oh, I have a gym membership and I go 4 times a week. Yes, if somebody else lifts all the weight, you didn't achieve anything, no muscle. And therefore he said, you can't use the Beit Yosef. They had learned in the fun of Sefer Turim, and they would use the Sefer Hatur. For who haya amin makoru niftach l'kol din shebashat. And he would give them in the shir an explanation from of where the Torah gets it from. But don't use the Beit Yosef. He never forgot anything. Because he was brilliant. So achacha gezeira, but then after he made this gezeira and his care, which we mentioned, yom echad lamdu din echad v'harav loy matzah yad v'harag lam v'beit ha-midrash v'ne'elam imen ha-bikiyun. The rav forgot the halacha all of a sudden, and he didn't know what the answer was. V'tarach v'chippas achachippas, and he looked and he looked pishlech v'lo matzah, and he couldn't find the halacha. Av ama harav, and then the rav said, nirishem in a shamayim rotin shebet yosef yifpashet olam. Because eventually they only found it by using the Bet Yosef, the very book that the Rav had said that he didn't want them to use, and he saw that as a siman min hashamayim, that maybe it's not so bad after all, and then he allowed them to use the Bet Yosef, but the early acceptance was very limited. People were very nervous about it. Later on, of course, the Sfarim accepted Maran. The Rav Bet Yosef is called Maran, which the Chida says is short for Ma'atayim Rabbanim Ne'emanim. The 200 great rabbis agreed to this situation, to this process of producing the Bet Yosef, and I brought you now various different examples of how the Sfarim later definitely followed the Bet Yosef, and now the Maran Bet Yosef, certainly with the rulings of Rav Avadi Yosef, I'm sure people are familiar with Rav Beni Lau. Rav Beni Lau in the Ramban Shul down in Katamon, his PhD thesis was on the Mishnah of Rav Avadi Yosef. And how Rav Avadi Yosef absolutely champions the psak of Rav Yosef Karo, okay? The Bet Yosef. And his whole, you can buy the book, it's called Mimaran Ad Maran, and he talks about how really in the Sephardi world, the Bet Yosef eventually became absolutely accepted, no question, and that's how it is today. The Ashkenazim were less enthusiastic. The first issue is the Ramah. The Ramah comes along, there were basically two responses with the Ashkenazim. The first one was, yes, but. Yes, but. Meaning the Ramah comes along and says, this book is fantastic, Shulchan Aruch, etc. But, don't you think it's just a touch Sfardi? Meaning, you wrote this book for everybody. And who did you base it on? The Rif? Sfardi. The Rambam? Sfardi. The Rosh? Ashkenazi, but the Sfardi makes sense to them as Sfardi. Okay? Three Sfardi! And you chose them and you're taking the majority of between them? Says, that doesn't work. What about Rashi? What about Tosfah? What about the Minhagim that we have in Ashkenaz? And therefore the Ramah said, you know something, I'm not going to write a whole new book. Because if I write a whole new Shulchan Aruch, it defeats the whole purpose of the Shulchan Aruch. The whole point is there should be one book, not two books. If you already start with two books, it's the beginning of the end. So he wrote, as I mentioned, to the Shulchan Aruch, and said to him, can I just insert occasional comments in the Shulchan Aruch where I need to kind of Ashkenazi-fine the book a little. And the Shulchan Aruch, in fairness to him, wrote back to him, Rabbi Yosef Karo, and said, yes, let's do it. And that's what you find. When you pick up a Shulchan Aruch off the shelf today, it's in two fonts. The majority of it is the writing of Rabbi Yosef Karo. And occasionally you find comments where the Ramah comes in and says, yeah, but our Psak is not like that, or our Minhag is not like that. It's not clear whether he's stricter or less strict. It depends on which area you're talking about, whether it's Hilchas Kashrus. Some places he's stricter, some places not. I give you an example. When it comes to waiting between meat and milk, the Shulchan Aruch simply brings the psak of the Rambam, which is 6 hours, though actually the Rambam said into the 6 hour, but he brings it to 6 hours, and he says, that's it, if you're Sfardi, you wait 6 hours. The Ramah comes in and says, whoa, one second. That's not what we do. Our psak in Ashkenazi land was actually not to wait any hours. It was just to not eat meat and milk in the same meal. But what we would do is after eating meat, we would bench, clear the table, wash our hands, wash our mouth, and eat cheesecake straight away. 15 minutes later. Less than the Dutch. The Dutch wait 1 hour. Here he's talking about 15 minutes. He says, that's upset. That was upset. Then we got hold of the Zohar, he says, he charts it all through. Then we got hold of the Zohar, which said, no, not in the same hour. So then we all went Dutch. Yeah, as it were, which was everybody, and we said a straight 1 hour, but 1 hour is it? And then he said other people keep a little bit more, but we certainly don't keep a straight six. That is not our sack, and there are many examples like that. Ultimately, the Ramah was extremely positive about Rav Yosef Karo. Look at number 17. Uvati lahashiv mipnei hakovad ledivrei hagon hagadol moreinu rabbeinu Yosef Karo. This is the Ramah writing about him. Hashem yamav anu meimav. And who shows him we drink from his water, mikan kano, v'kador. Ma oistis, b'shvacho l'chavdo. How can I praise him more? How can I say greater things? Al kenet palal Hashem, ala atid l'harich, yemei moreinu, rabbeinu, his life may be lengthened. Nasi elokim betocheinu, v'hine chalil l'hamrod divrei, You can't go against him. Okay? Demar, v'chol ha'cholik alav k'cholik al ha'shechina. Nobody writes that about other people in the same way. So he wrote that about the Rav Yosef Karo. So his response was very much, yes, but. However, other Ashkenazim said, no. And very clearly, no. And let me give you this example, which I think is going to be quite shocking in some ways. The Yamshel Shlomo, number 18. Let's have a look together at number 18. The last 5 or 6 minutes, let's look at these together. The Yamshel Shlomo, the Shlomo Luria in Poland, said, no way. Ki chavash mikarov bali adenu sefer v'chibu she'asam arenu ha-Rav Yosef Karo. Alatorim. We have this new book we found from Rav Yosef Karo on the tour. V'erikam ha-chidushim mitzvarim ha-kodmonim she'loi hayu bi'adayim bi'yamim she'avru. We never had a lot of these ideas before. He's done a great job collecting everything together. U'tshuvas nachriyot v'chidushim asher nimtzu b'chol ha-sarim. He's brought all these interesting, unusual tshuvas that we've never seen before. He didn't leave anything out. It's almost as if there's no way we can oppose this. I mean, what can you say when you're faced with this book?
Aval.
And this is the big aval. Asap sharot. Be'inyan epizki halacha. He's made compromises in halacha. Midato, from his own view. U'mitzvarat ha-keres. Where's your keres? Got voice for it. He says, meaning... this is a majority. A majority between three people that you chose, okay, and then you go for 2 out of 6. That's not how Achrei Rabbi Lahapolis works. Majority was in the Sanhedrin. 71 great rabbis. 40, 31, 20, 51. Now that's the majority. But 2 against 1 out of the people you chose, that's not a majority. Meaning here, Kabbalah means the received traditions of our communities. He goes against our tradition. The Talmidim love the book, he says. And they don't realize that it's a very dangerous affair what they're doing here. He very often goes against Tosfos and the people that we follow. The Talmidim are making a big mistake. They just read what it says in the book. Shikach halacha, but this is halacha. For Amru, and they say, kach kasav akaru lehedya. This is what it says in the book. Ki kach ha'inyan hara ashel itnehem. And this is very bad, he says. Mashakasav b'sefer ya'aminu. They believe something. Why? Because it's written in a book. Why would you believe something because it's written in a book? That's not how you pass in halacha. Im yamod acher v'achad v'chai, and someone stands up and screams, tzaveh chakrukia, and crows like a cockerel, she'ein adin kach, that's not the halacha, v'rayat gemurus, and he brings good proof, or afilu b'kabbalah, or a tradition, lo yachish v'dvarav. They don't pay any attention to him. Ka'ashe kasati v'hagdama rishona. U'b'prat ha'idne, especially today, here's a little bit of a negative comment, she'abavonot ha'rabim ha'nismachim rubim. There are many people with smicha, v'halundim mu'atim. But not many people with knowledge. Umishum hachi, toisim divrei ha-sefer. That's why they like this book. Hashem atu b'kol ha-chidushim. Ubezeh ushvu ha-ketanim le-gedolim v'hanayim le-zikeinim. Because now everybody's on the same playing field, because you just read what it says in the book. Everyone's a Talmud Chacham. They saw it on the internet. Okay? And he says, we can't do this. Not 19, v'loi zeh ha-derech, v'loi zeh ha-ir. This is not the way, this is not the approach. We no longer follow one opinion from the Gemara, or min achron, whether earlier or later, elami sheyichshu dvara, but someone who has the ability what we do now is the following. We do not pass an halacha from a book. We read the Talmud, you become a great Talmudic genius. You learn the Talmud, and you put together the sugyas, and you reach a halacha based on what? Your own understanding. And if you don't happen to be a world Talmudic genius, so then ask someone who is. But don't look it up in a book. How can you do that? That's not fact. And this position was reflected by many. I'm not going to go through them all now. The Maharsha says the same thing. The Bach says the same thing. The Maharal of Prague, number 23, which I'm not going to go through in detail now. The Maharal of Prague says that since is an intellectual exercise in working through the Talmud, better you should work through the Talmud and reach the wrong psak than look it up in a book and reach the right psak. Obviously, he's not talking about someone who doesn't know what they're doing. Someone who doesn't know what they're doing better not do that. But someone who knows what they're doing, they have a skill, and for whatever reason they just misjudge it, that's fact. That's how it works. You don't look it up in a book. And therefore there was a strong Ashkenazi response to the Shulchan Aruch, which was negative. In fact, there was a whole rival Shulchan Aruch written by Rav Mordechai Yaffa, the Levush. Okay, that's the end of the shir, basically. But I'll be finishing in 30 seconds. But bottom line, over the last 300 years, the Shulchan Aruch has won the day. Not only with the Sfaradim, but also with the Ashkenazim. I brought you some final sources here in 24 and 25, how later on, even the Ashkenazim accepted that the Shulchan Aruch was preeminent, and that is actually, in many ways, how the halacha works today. So Rabbi Yosef Karo, both through the halacha, and also through his mysticism, has had a massive impact on the world, and will continue, I'm sure, to do so. Although, it must be said, and I'll just finish with this comment, even Ad Hayom Hazeh, there are great Lithuanian, if you like, in the Lithuanian school of poskim, like Rav Moshe Feinstein, who do not feel themselves entirely bound by the Shulchan Aruch, and where they can bring a proof from the Gemara which goes against, they have the shoulders in which to do that. Less and less, but that happens occasionally. So hopefully we know a little bit more about Rav Karo. Thank you again for inviting me. I wish you all a good week, and hopefully we'll see you soon.